What should you do basically after you have signed up with a new account on Upwork? How do you get people to notice you, and how do you get to reasonable hourly rates? Because what I imagine is that a lot of people there want their app built for like $20 or something like that.
Yeah, so as soon as you sign up, there's a few things that you need to do before you even start applying for positions.
Welcome to the Coding in Flow podcast. My name is Florian Walter, and in this show, I interview interesting people from the programming industry to learn from them about software engineering, career development, and life in general. In this episode, I will be talking to Don Felker. Don is a software developer and freelancer with over 20 years of experience in the industry. He has worked on really big apps like MyFitnessPal, Groupon, and American Express. He's also the co-host of the Fragmented podcast, which is a software developer podcast that's especially popular in Android circles because they started out as an Android podcast. And I personally, I've been listening to this podcast pretty much since I started Android, so it has traveled with me along the way. Don is also an author, and he has recently released a new book called Freelance Tactics, 10 Tactics That Will Help You Succeed and Thrive in Freelancing. And this is what we will mainly talk about today. In this episode, we will cover pretty much all questions you had about getting started with freelancing, like how to get clients in the first place, how to price yourself, what hourly rate you should charge, traps you have to avoid along the way, and much more. So this episode is really packed with information. I think it's a great episode, and just lean back and enjoy the interview. I'm also happy to announce that we got a sponsor for this episode, which is Stream with their amazing chat SDK. If you have ever tried to build a real-time chat app from scratch, you know how difficult it is. Features like live messages with pagination, offline support, or group chats are really hard to get right. Now, when you use the Stream SDK to build your chat, all of this just works right out of the box. It's extremely easy to get started with, but at the same time, it's very customizable. It's built with modern app architecture in mind, and you can use it with XML or Jetpack Compose, Kotlin or Java, or pretty much any other language and platform. I was blown away by how easy it is to use, how well it works, and how good the documentation is. And the best thing, it's completely free if you're making less than $10,000 in monthly revenue and have less than 5 team members. So if you're planning to implement a chat into your app, do yourself a favor and give Stream a try. You can find out more by clicking the link in the description or visit getstream.io/codinginflow. And now back to today's interview. Okay, so first of all, I want to ask you, how late is it where you live?
It's pretty early. It's 5 in the morning. I got up about an hour ago to make sure I could prepare.
Yeah, so everyone watching this, we have to appreciate that Don woke up like 4 or 5 a.m. to take this interview. So this is some dedication. I like to start a podcast usually with the guests telling a few sentences about their personal life as much as you're comfortable with. Maybe you can tell us what your hobbies are and also how you got into programming and what do you like about programming?
Yeah, so my hobbies are mainly around fitness and health. I spend a lot of time in the gym. It's kind of where a lot of my social interactions come from, so I do a lot of that. I like to spend a lot of time outside doing outdoor activities. Could be mountain biking or anything like that. So that's kind of the general hobbies. On top of that, I'm learning piano and just trying to also learn some other languages as well. So actual, you know, speaking languages, not programming languages. And how I got into programming was actually by accident. Early in my early 20s, I had never touched a computer before. And I was working as a motorcycle mechanic, and I had a girlfriend that showed me her computer, and she was getting ready one day and she said, "Hey, why don't you hop on the internet?" And I hopped on she showed me what the internet was. I had no idea. And 2 weeks later, I bought my first computer and I never looked back at that point forward. I went and found a book on HTML and wanted to learn how to create a web page. And that was my first foray into programming. And then it just opened up the entire rabbit hole that we are all now a part of.
Okay, nice. Yeah. In this day and age, it's definitely good to be into computers.
Yeah.
You learn piano right now. Is that difficult? That's an interesting thing.
It's a little bit difficult. I'm actually taking this course by, it's called Piano for All. So, you know, again, not sponsored or anything, but it's a course I found on Udemy. And it's really easy to follow along. I had tried to learn guitar and other instruments, and none of it ever really made sense. But since starting down this path with this course, it's actually been pretty, takes a lot of practice, but it's not as bad as I thought it would be.
Didn't you have some history as a music producer or something like that?
Yes.
In the music business?
That's right. And in my 20s, when I was also doing programming, I basically self-funded my own record label for 7 years. We toured the country. I had a tour van, the whole tour tent, everything. I had multiple bands underneath my label. I managed all of them myself. I wasn't in any of the bands. But it was about 7 years of my life where I was in the music industry full time. So 40 hours of the week I was programming. That paid for the music industry to try to get that going. And after losing a lot of money after 7 years, I decided to fold that up and say, this is not working.
Okay, definitely sounds like an adventure.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. It was a wild time. Something I don't regret it at all. It's just, you know, I tell people all the time that if you want to go do something, then just go try it. Like as the old trope says, you're never going to be at your deathbed saying like, oh wow, I'm upset that I tried something. You're going to be upset that you didn't try it.
Yeah, that's true. And we live in a time where trying something and turning it into a profession is easier than ever.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to try something, in my opinion, even if it's a bit riskier.
Well, you're a case in point there with your YouTube channel. I mean, congratulations on all your success over there.
Yeah, thank you. But the thing with the YouTube channel is that I was always killing two birds with one stone because I wanted to learn programming anyway. And even if the YouTube channel failed, I could just take a job. So it was never really very risky, in my opinion, because I was learning programming and that's really a future proof. Mm-hmm. So this was my approach with that. Okay, and the main theme of this episode will be freelancing, because you recently released a new book. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
It's called Freelance Tactics, and the full title is Freelance Tactics, 10 Tactics That Will Help You Succeed and Thrive in Freelancing. And I've listened to it in the gym, and it was really a pleasure to listen to it. It was really nicely written. So I recommend everyone to check out the book.
Thank you.
Buy it. Some parts of it are really US-specific. This is something you have to keep in mind, but usually you can still apply it wherever, no matter where you live. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the tax stuff about the IRS, that's different in other countries, but the general concepts are really the same. So I recommend that everyone checks out this book.
Yeah, thank you, Florian.
Okay, and when I ask people what questions they have about freelancing, then the first and most important question usually is, how can someone get started with freelancing? How can they get clients? This is what people have problems with.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different places you can go. I think a lot of people right now lean towards some place like Upwork, which can be very challenging because there's so much competition on Upwork. And when I started freelancing, there was no Upwork. There might have been a couple of sites that allowed it, but they weren't that good and no one really used them. And so while you can use Upwork, and I do recommend people try going there, there's many other options in where you can start freelancing. And so that's going to be friends and family of people who need something. Now, this could be a website, it could be an app, it could be helping them with an Excel spreadsheet where they need to create a macro of some sort. It could be anything. And one of the best places that you can actually start finding some of these people is through your friends and your family, and start reaching out and seeing if they need any help with anything. And then as people start realizing what you're capable of doing, which I'm sure we've all run into now and then of like, hey, I need an app. You can maybe write an app. Now, not everybody needs an app, but what I have found personally, and this is where I started, is I started in the web. And so for me, consulting in the web was a lot easier because I could find a company or a small business or anything of that nature that needed maybe a website, maybe something small, Maybe they need some automation set up. Maybe they need help set up in some tech area. So you have to also be willing to step out of your initial comfort zone if you want to just start experimenting and starting to get clients. If you can't find any of those folks, then a good place to start is actually going to be somewhere like Upwork, where you can start talking and applying to various different positions and so forth on Upwork. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can go about this. It really depends on what you're looking to do. Is it going to be, A, I want to just kind of make some side income just so I have some extra money for the holidays, or just kind of have some spending money? Or B, is this something that I want to turn into a full-time job? And depends on which one of those you are approaching it as, it depends kind of where you're going to really want to focus a lot of your time and effort.
Okay, yeah. Asking friends and family and maybe smaller businesses around you, around your local area, is something probably people don't often do because they're not comfortable doing this. Mm-hmm. But it's a good idea. I mean, it's a good way to find your first clients probably.
Yeah. And one of the things I think I maybe even spoke about this in the book a little bit, and it's going to be in my next book for sure, is that you can go speak at small little meetup groups. So let's just take real estate as an example. Maybe there's a real estate meetup and maybe you're an expert in, or maybe an expert, but just you're pretty good at SEO or content marketing for whatever reason. You can then put a presentation together and tailor that towards real estate professionals, contact the meetup organizer, say, hey, I have a presentation on how real estate agents can improve the SEO rankings of their real estate websites, and I can give this presentation for free. What this will do is it'll get you in front of the people that have the money to spend, and you are then stepping in front of them, providing your expertise, showing that you're the expert. And what ends up happening is people see you, you know, on stage or wherever, and this could only be in front of five people who, you know, these meetups could be small, but these things turn into opportunities because now you've exposed them and taught them something they didn't know, and you've potentially helped them make more money. You know, if again, using the SEO example, maybe you can get this real estate in front of more eyeballs and it sells the house faster. That person may reach out to you saying, hey, how much do you charge for your services? Right there, that's a lead. Now you just have to continue to nurture that lead and hopefully turn it into some type of consulting or freelancing engagement.
Yeah, I think what people as usual do wrong is they don't want to put in the work, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to put themselves out there. People expect that they sign up on a site like Upwork and it will just work right away. They will get clients automatically, but this is unfortunately not how it works. So you have to put in the work. You have to, as you said, you can make these speaking gigs. You can ask people around you. And of course, it's also important to put content on. So this is something you often talk about. I watched your videos about this. And what I do myself, I create content to market myself, basically, which of course is also work, but it's also important because this is how you can use the internet to get people to know you and to come to you, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you put the content out there. If you're sharing your knowledge, people are going to find it. Now, something, and you've realized this, Florian, is that something you create today, you may not get any leads from ever. But something you create tomorrow, again, you may not get any leads on for 2, 3, 6, 9 months down the road, but randomly someone says, hey, I watched your video or I read your blog post on this topic, and that's something we're having a problem with. Is that something that you can help us with? And it might be a couple hour project. It might be a couple weeks or whatever. And one thing I forgot to mention with the starting with recruiting is, even though if maybe you're not comfortable with producing content or making videos or even making a podcast or whatever, there's still other options out there. Depending upon where you're at in the world, there's certain recruiters that you can reach out to. And I have many friends that make a very lucrative freelancing career simply by befriending a lot of recruiters. And they'll go out to lunch with these recruiters, become friends with them. And these recruiters basically end up just funneling them new contracts because companies come to these recruiters saying, hey, we need an Android app developer that knows X, Y, and Z. And that person says, oh yeah, I know that person. That's Florian. Florian, I go to lunch with him all the time. Let me see if he's available. And all of a sudden you have an email in your inbox. Hey, there's someone who needs a contract for 4 months to write this Android app. You interested? And so you can Now, you have to understand how recruiters work. They do take some money off the top, but they can do a lot of the work for you on the side, so you don't have to be out there hustling. Or if you don't want to, maybe your lifestyle doesn't support it, there are other options.
Yeah, this is something you mentioned in your book as well, that many people are unfriendly towards recruiters. A good strategy is to be nice to them, and then they will remember you, which of course is a good strategy in general to interact with other people.
Yeah, just to recap what it says in the book is, you're right. If you just go on Twitter and you just follow a lot of the tech community, you'll see them complain all the time about recruiters, about this recruiter emailed me and they asked for a COBOL position and I'm a Java developer. I'm just like, all right, yeah, they're just literally blasting out an email. And so I get all those emails too. And here's the thing that I do and I recommend in my book is I create a template inside of Gmail that says, it's a canned response that you think you have to turn it on in the settings somewhere. And in that canned response, it says, hey, thanks for reaching out. I'm currently booked up for the next 3 to 6 months. Please reach out to me around that time again, as you know, I might be available for some future opportunities. Thanks. Have a great day, Don. And then when I get those emails from recruiters, I just simply reply with that canned response. It takes me a second. Replace the hello, and I put hello Tom or hello Sarah, whoever sent me the email, just so it's a little more personalized. Then I send it, and then I label it as recruiter and archive it. Now, what I've just done is I've become one of the very few people who's ever replied to that recruiter, and that recruiter will remember that, and they will put me in their CRM system, so customer relationship management system, to follow up with me in 3 to 6 months. It'll just pop up on their screen saying, hey, email Don about a new position. They'll look at their notes. They'll email me. I've been friendly to them. They're going to remember that. And then also on my side, this helps me because let's say tomorrow, for whatever reason, I'm working for a startup and that startup runs out of money. And oh my goodness, I got to go find a contract. I don't have any money coming in. What can I do? And I've done this, is I go into my Gmail, I go to that recruiter label and I email all my recruiters saying, hey, I'm available. Do you have anything? Here's my current specialties. I can tell you right now, within 24 hours, I'll have multiple job opportunities just lined up simply because of developing those relationships. So yes, be nice to them. They can help you in a pinch.
Yeah, this is something that is also explained in the popular book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yes.
You probably know that book. Mm-hmm. That's basically what it says. Be nice to people. Don't follow just your emotions when you interact with people, because then you will... Yeah, then the stuff happens that happens on Twitter, where everyone is just complaining about them because they contacted them in the wrong time of the day or with the wrong sentences or something like that. So, be nice to recruiters, be nice to people in general. It's a good strategy. One thing also people often ask is, when it comes to creating content, do people have to... create videos on YouTube and videos on Instagram and stuff like that, or is blogging enough? Do you think just having a blog in text form is enough to market yourself?
Nowadays, that's a hard one. I can't say for 100% certainty that just a blog is enough. I know that when I started, that's exactly what I did, is I just blogged about everything. Now, if you're not comfortable recording audio, recording video, you do have to start somewhere. So just start writing. That's going to be the easiest for you. It's going to give you a lot of long tail SEO traffic. And especially, and even if you don't even know what to write about, you could just write about what you've been developing. Even if someone's already written about the Android lifecycle before, you can write about it too, because you might put a specific spin on it that no one else has really talked about. And it might help a particular developer somewhere finally understand a certain part of the lifecycle. And that might make them reach out. Now, is that enough? It might be. That might be enough to kick you off in your career. However, nowadays there's so many different social channels. I recommend that you get into as many as possible. I mean, there's folks like Gary Vee that, you know, if you follow him, he's telling you to post 100 pieces of content a day or something, which is, it's hard. I mean, if you're posting tweets, it's, you know, that's considered a piece of content, but 100 is a lot. So I'd say start with something that you're comfortable with. If that's blogging, start with that and then branch out and then continue to grow into the different social platforms as you can, because it's just going to be more you know, think of it as windows on your business. You know, you're just exposing yourself to more and more opportunities with more platforms you get on.
Yeah, and one option that just came to my mind is what I did. People can also do screencasts where they just talk and don't show themselves. It worked really well for me. I think I had 100,000 subscribers before I showed my face for the first time or something like that.
The big unveil.
Yes, I was not comfortable with it, but now I suddenly am. I don't know, something switched and then I was suddenly comfortable with it. But people should, when they make videos, they should use a microphone and talk. Because these videos where people don't talk, they never get a lot of clicks, or very rarely. So I think voice is important. And if people want to write a blog, should they do it on Medium or on their personal website? I think you are a fan on personal websites,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of personal because Medium has a great writing experience. Their editor is fantastic. Their recommendation engine is brilliant. The problem that I have with Medium is that you become the product, meaning that if you've ever read a lot of Medium articles, eventually you'll hit the Medium paywall. Now, there is some rhyme and reason to when that happens. However, it's very frustrating at times, and I don't want my content ever walled behind some business garden. So I prefer to own everything, so I want to put it all on my personal website. Now, that's also because I tend to use WordPress. You can use Ghost, whatever you want to use. I like to use WordPress simply because it just works. I don't want to have to worry about developing, writing my own blog engine. I just want to worry about writing content. And then also the great thing about something like WordPress is the number of plugins that you have. You can provide, you know, email opt-ins, you can sell things through, you know, purchase plugins. So there's a ton of different options that you can do with WordPress. So yeah, I'm a humongous fan of just posting it on your own site because you control all the content. And as long as you are following proper, you know, decent SEO practices, Google will find it and it will get indexed and you will get the traffic. So that's definitely what I prefer.
Yeah, I'm a fan of WordPress too. It just makes it so easy. And the nice thing about WordPress is that you can start with almost no technical experience, mm-hmm. but you can go deeper if you want. Can change the nitty-gritty stuff. You can change CSS and everything. You can write real code, but you don't have to. And this is the nice thing about it, in my opinion.
Yes.
And regarding Medium, yeah, it makes sense to own the stuff that you create. But it's not really the case for me because I mostly use social media sites. I don't really own the stuff on YouTube, but I had a website. But the problem with video stuff like videos is that you can't really host them yourself.
Yeah.
For videos, you have to use social media. But I think also a nice way to not be too dependent on these sites is just to spread out your content across different websites.
Yeah.
And build a brand, because then even when one of these sites blocks you or goes down or changes their terms, people will still find you because they know your name or your brand.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I'm pretty sure that you do this. I know I do this, is that across the different platforms, you use the same username. That's what you do too, right? So all of yours is Coding and Flow, right?
Right.
Yeah, so for folks that are not familiar, if you're going to be on the different platforms such as Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, whatever you might be on, TikTok, make sure that you're using the same username across all of them. So mine is always Don Felker. Now, if you have a very common name like John Smith, you might have to come up with something different. You know, it might be like Coding and Flow 2. I'm just kidding. So come up with that and then it makes it easy to find.
Yeah, this is something I regret in hindsight, that I created a fantasy brand with a fantasy name. If I would do it over again, I would use my own name. It's better, in my opinion, to build a personal brand with your own name. But now I can't really change it anymore because I have so many links out there that go to Coding and Flow, and the name is mentioned in so many places. I would really lose a lot of SEO power, basically, so search engine power, if I would now switch to my own personal name. And I think it's still fine. I still think I do have a personal brand in some way because I show my face, people know my name, so I still have a personal brand. But it would be better if my YouTube channel and Instagram accounts and everything would also be named Florian Walter in hindsight. So this is what I recommend to people. Okay, maybe you can talk a bit more generally about Upwork. So I know that Philip Lackner, for example, started on Upwork, but he also said it's not like you sign up there and then clients will just flood in. So what should you do basically after you have signed up with a new account on Upwork? How do you get people to notice you, and how do you get to reasonable hourly rates? Because what I imagine is that a lot of people there want their app built for like $20 or something like that.
Yeah, so as soon as you sign up, there's a few things that you need to do before you even start applying for positions. And that is, you need to make sure that your profile is 100% fleshed out. So you need to make sure that you have everything filled out inside of it. You need to make sure your biography states what you do, how you do it. Now, this kind of gets into some copywriting stuff. So you want to make sure that you're talking to the person who is going to be hiring, maybe a hiring manager, maybe someone who's, you know, a startup owner, whatever. You want to write it, and when you're writing your bio, you want to read it back to yourself as if you were the person hiring you. So like, why does this sentence even make sense? Does this sell my services? Does this make me look any better? So there's a lot of books on copywriting. One of them, I have this one here. It's this one's pretty good. It's called Copywriting Secrets. This is it's a pretty good book here.
Yeah, we'll put a link to this into the show notes.
And it's a really straightforward book, and he walks you through like a lot of the stuff. Now, here's the thing, caveat. Some people are going to read this and be like, oh my goodness, this is so salesy, and like, this makes me feel dirty. And that, if you just remove that emotion from it and just read it and then just open your eyes to the rest of the world, what you'll see is you're being sold everywhere. You just don't even know it. So once you start learning some of these copywriting things, it's can change everything for you. So you got to fill out your profile. You got to make sure that you're targeting what you're doing and who your target audience is, which is going to be the clients. If you're a mobile developer, then talk about being a mobile developer. I would not create a profile that says, I'm a software developer, I can write what you want. Like, what do you do? Like, I don't know. Now, if you are an Android developer, you have a specialty in Android, then you should say, you know, my specialty is in Android development. I work with Jetpack Compose. I have built the following, you know, 5 websites. I have, you know, have 5 years of experience, and I've used these technologies. As a hiring manager, I want to look and see, I'm like, okay, wow, this person knows Jetpack. They know, you know, how to do unit testing. They know Espresso. Okay, great. And then, which is very important, you need to make sure you have your portfolio filled out, because people are visual. They want to see what you've built. Now, even if you're not the designer on the project, for example, on some of the apps that I've helped build, which are, you know, Groupon and MyFitnessPal and American Express, like, I wasn't the designer on these apps. Like, there's specific designers that design the look and the feel of the apps. Yes, did I code them? Yes, I did. But people want to see the actual apps. And so I will take the screenshot saying I developed this app and this app and this app, and I'll have multiple different pieces, multiple different portfolio pieces, simply because people want to see what I've built. And you want to put your best stuff first, because the first couple of pieces of portfolio is what's going to grab their eye, and each one should drive the person into the next one. So you want your best one first, your next best one, then your next best one, because that's what's going to sell you. And so once you finally have your profile kind of fleshed out, you've kind of talked about any of the social proof you have, which might be, for example, Florian, if you had an Upwork account, I would recommend saying, hey, I have a YouTube channel where I teach over 100,000 Android, you know, developers, or however you want to say it, Android developers through YouTube. I have over 100,000 plus subscriptions to my YouTube channel, and it's all focused on Android development. Have, you know, over this many million views on all of my videos, and you can see my channel here. And I provide it, you know, I don't think you can put a link in your bio inside of Upwork, but you can do that somewhere else, where I'll tell you in a second. So you want to provide all the social proof you have. You know, I teach this many people on my weekly Instagram lives, where we talk about all the tips and tricks for Android. So social proof. You want to make sure you got your portfolio. Now your portfolio is looking good. Like, wow, okay, this person has this. Okay, what if you don't have social proof? That's fine. You can still talk about things that you've done. Maybe you have spoken at your company's lunch meeting about how you can do X, Y, and Z. You can spin that positively. Like, you know, recently taught a team of 10 developers how to use Espresso. Like, okay, might have been just your teammates. That's still fine. That still counts. Now, after that, the next part is, okay, I want to apply for a job on Upwork. Now, when you apply for the job, the number one thing you need to make sure you're doing is actually reading the title and the entire job posting. And inside the job posting, there might be special instructions. And this is something I do. I've hired over 65 contractors off of Upwork over the last decade. And this is something I do to filter people out. And what I will do, for example, is somewhere inside of my job posting, which is not very long, I'll say, please, when you're applying to the job posting, please include the word, you know, let's say coffee in the job posting, just so that I know that you've read it. If you don't include the word coffee, I will decline your job application for not following directions. And as an employer, there's actually a section where I can decline a candidate saying that they did not follow the job posting requirements. And you will be amazed. I just posted a job posting for a graphics designer that I needed. And I'd probably say 70% of the people that applied didn't even include the keyword, which means they didn't even read the posting at all. And so I declined 70% of the people that apply. And so you can literally hop to the front of the line if you're reading these posts. Now, I realize not everybody does this. So read the job posting. There might also be something else in there like, hey, provide a, you know, this, what's the solution to, you know, 12 plus 5. It just could be something very simple, again, to verify that you've read it. So once you've done that and you're going to press apply, you apply that keyword or whatever the answer is, if there is one. Now inside of your application, what you need to do is make sure you say, hey, I'm interested in working on your whatever the title of the posting is, you know, Android developer, iOS developer, whatever. Here's the experience I have. I've built this app, this app, this app. Immediately links, just links. You want direct links. You don't want to say, hey, oh, I've built the Groupon app and the MyFitnessPal app. Yeah, people know what those apps are most of the time because those are big apps, but a lot of people haven't worked on big apps. So you need to provide links to the actual apps. Provide links to either a portfolio or directly to the app itself inside of one of the app stores. The goal here is to make it super easy on the hiring manager so that when they see the job application, remember, they're not seeing one of these, they're seeing hundreds. When they see that link, oh, they just click on it because that's what's going to happen. And that's what I do. I click on it. I look, I scan. I'm like, okay, that's impressive. Close. Let me look at the next link. Provide the best ones down to, you know, I'd say the top five, then fill it out with any additional information you have about the job posting. Hey, I'm interested in working with you. Here's when I'm available. You know, please reach out if you're interested. That right there is going to put you way ahead of the game simply because you have provided the links and made it easy on the hiring manager to make a decision because you are basically allowing them to just click and see what they need to see, and it promotes all of your work. Now, on the flip side of this is I've just explained a very good job posting that looks good, is probably a good employer. Now there's a ton of bad stuff on Upwork where they say, hey, I want you to create a Reddit clone for $500. That's my budget.
Classic.
Just ignore those. That is a humongous can of worms. It's going to be nothing but trouble. I would not even approach those. I just completely ignore them. I just skim right over them. There's a lot of them out there. Now, there are going to be a lot of them out there that say, hey, I need someone to, you know, automate a script for, you know, scraping a website every 24 hours. Like, okay, that's a valid job and it might be just a very short one. That's a good one to get your feet wet. So you just have to make sure that if it feels wrong, like, wow, this person wants me to build a Reddit clone for $500, like, that's not happening. So if it doesn't feel right, don't go down that path. And then what you'll want to do is get some quick wins. This is going to be the best thing for you initially on Upwork. Is as soon as you can get a quick win, maybe it's that scripting job where you're going to be scraping a website for whatever reason, and it's only going to be a two-day job. Get that quick win, knock it out of the park, really do a great job, finish it quickly, deliver the deliverables, and then get the review. Make sure you ask for a review, and you want your reviews, of course, to be 5-star. And if you can get these reviews, as many reviews as you can, the more likely that Upwork is going to start ranking your profile as a rising talent. So the quick wins are going to help you do that. So if you take this quick couple of jobs just to get a couple of things underneath your portfolio, it's just going to make your profile look that much stronger overall. Very long-winded response, but that's it.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of nice nuggets of information in there. So basically, getting clients on Upwork is still very similar to writing a normal job application in terms of you have to show what you can do and what your experience is, and you have to stand out in some way. Mm-hmm. And you can stand out just by showing that you thoroughly read all the instructions, for example, or by putting links to your projects that you worked on into your application, just so that someone who glances over it quickly, that it stands out to them as interesting. And on Upwork, there are some features like these reviews, which you have directly on the site. And I think you can also get some kind of certificates on Upwork by doing certain tests with them.
Yeah, I know that they used to have these tests where, for example, I used to hire a lot of Rails developers, and they could say they've tested within the top 98th percentile of the Rails test. I don't know if they still have those. I was talking to someone last week about this, and I'm not sure if that's been removed or not, so I'd have to double check.
Okay. Yeah, Philip Luckner mentioned something like this, that they contacted him to do some kind of data structures test so he gets a badge on his profile. And I think they also have one for Android.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay, so this is how to get started on Upwork. Would you recommend that people work for an hourly rate or for a fixed price per project?
This one can be really sticky here. So my own experience is I have been burned many times on fixed bid projects. So that's the fixed price project. And the main reason for that is because a client says that they want these features and they only want to spend $1,000. Every single time, there's additional features, there's additional changes. So they can work, it just requires more administrative work. And as long as you can manage that client effectively, that will work. So you want to get as many requirements as you can up front for a fixed bid project. Otherwise, you can kind of spiral out of control and you'll end up spending more time on it and losing money. So personally, I recommend and prefer as much hourly work as possible. However, there is a kind of a bridge that you can gap here. And one of those things is sometimes you might need to take a fixed bid project, deliver that fixed bid project, and then what you end up finding out is if you really do a good job on that, the client might say, hey, we need some more work done on this. How much would it cost to add this feature? And it might turn into a kind of a recurring fixed bid thing, or you can come back to them and say, hey, you know what? I'm not sure. And this is what I recommend, providing a range back to them saying, well, that feature, it's going to take anywhere from, 3 to 5 days to do that feature. So why don't we just start with that and see where we're at in 3 days? And then we can continue to go from there, and we'll just go hourly. And then we'll check in every day to see if you want to keep going or not. So you can slowly start transitioning your client from a fixed bid into an hourly project, which I have actually done multiple times as well.
Okay, the reason why it's called fixed bid project when it's one fixed price. Mm-hmm. The reason why this seems interesting to me is because maybe I think I can get this project done much quicker than the client thought it would be possible. And then I can make a lot of money in terms of hourly rate. Is this realistic or not so much?
No, this is a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a very good, something you could very easily do. Now, give the perfect example. Let's say that you've built a banking application and you know how to connect to all the major banks and just, make a banking app. And you've done this, that's your forte. This is your expertise. You've done it 100 times. Another bank comes in and says, hey, we want you to create a banking app just like this other bank. And we want to spend, our budget is $100,000. And you already know that all you really need to do is, update a few API endpoints and make a few changes. It's going to take you a week. And yeah, sure. That's what a lot of companies do. If you can do that, this can be very lucrative for you. You just have to make sure that it's within your wheelhouse and you know that you can get it done. So it can be. You just have to make sure it's something you're very confident that you can do.
Okay, nice. And when you work for an hourly rate, what or how would you decide how big your rate is? And in your book, you mentioned something that was really eye-opening for me, and that is that people take a lot of costs in both money and time not into account when they calculate their hourly rate, for example, health insurance or the time it takes to find new clients. People don't take this into account and then they charge too little.
Yeah. So inside of this book here, which is the book we're talking about, Freelance Tactics, there's a chapter called the 2.1x method. And inside of there is where I break down the formula for that. And in short, the best way for you to really understand the things that you're not including are going, just like you said, are going to be the actual amount of time that it takes to find clients. It's going to be the downtime that you have. And so a lot of these things that you forget about, the insurance, when you work for a full-time company, let's just say you make $80,000 a year in the US, you are also getting other things that you're not aware of. You're getting paid time off. You're getting, in the United States, I think a large portion of your insurance is paid by your employer. There's a bunch of other stuff. You have a computer, you have internet access, you have a desk, you have a chair, you have air conditioning. There's just a bunch of stuff. You don't take that into account. It's just part of working at a company. So when you start working for yourself, you have to take a lot of these things into account. And that's where a lot of people fall down, is they'll say, hey, I make $80,000 a year. How many hours are in a year? If you take 40 hours a week, it's 2,080. And you just divide that, 80,000 divided by 2,080 and whatever that, which is 30 something dollars probably. They'll take that and say, all right, well, I'm going to charge that amount and I should be fine. And the problem with that is you're not taking into account your insurance. You're not taking into account that when things are not going to work out. So where do you start? This is part of the book also that I feel that in my next book, I'll be covering in more detail, that this is very US based in the book, is that the rates in there, because the rates that you can charge in the US are going to be different than the rates you can charge in Ukraine or India or something like that. So you need to be able to identify, you have to kind of change the numbers where you're based, where you're living. So you want to make sure that you're charging enough for your base income, which you were making before. And this is if you want to make full-time income, plus any of your additional expenses that you're going to have, maybe computers, plus any of your insurance, and then also any of the downtime, which people really do not anticipate, is they have a nice 3-month gig, it comes to a close, they don't have a gig for a whole month, they don't have a job. If you have money in the bank to sustain you while you're looking for a new job, that's fine. But you have to make sure you plan for that. And if you're charging enough, you can then take all the extra money that you've made, put it in the bank, save it for later, and then kind of live off that money. So that's all covered inside of this book here. And there's actually a free chapter. You can download the 2.1x method. I'll give you the link and people can download that for free and read it.
Okay, nice. I put that in the show notes as well. Yeah, in Germany, it's similar that if you have a normal job at a company, then they, I think they pay half of your health insurance or something like that. But it's something that people are not aware of when they work for themselves sometimes.
Yeah.
And yeah, so in lower wage countries where the costs of living are cheaper, like India, freelancing in the internet is basically easier, isn't it? Because they can compete with lower hourly rates and they can still live properly from that. Do you think they have an advantage when it comes to that?
I mean, they might have an advantage in that. Well, I would say yes, they do. If you are very good at what you do, and I have a large number of contractors that I work with from India that are very good at what they do, and I pay them more than what they normally get paid simply because I don't want them to leave, because I value what they're doing for me. And so just to give you an example, someone might charge, $100. I recommend people starting $100 an hour. Now, someone in India might only be charging $20 an hour or $12 an hour, simply because for them, that's a good wage over there. So they can and very often will do make good money for them over there. However, it's a very slippery slope, because there's a certain level at which an employer sees a rate and they think, wow, that's really cheap. I don't know if that's good work or not. And so I don't have that exact number of what that is, But let's just say you're charging $12 an hour to be an Android developer. Do those exist? Yeah, there's people that will do it for $12 an hour. What's the quality of the work? I don't know. I have paid people lower dollar amounts to try them out. They've ended up being fantastic developers, and I've doubled their rate just simply because I was already planning on spending that much and I don't want them to leave. So it can be very beneficial to them simply because they can have a lower standard of living and things are much cheaper over there. So just depends on their skill set and if they're willing to kind of up their rates and test the market.
Okay, yeah, I actually did my first freelance job for $10 per hour.
Oh, wow.
Because I thought like it's completely new for me. I just want to see how it works. And then I started for, this was someone I knew through my YouTube channel. But the problem was that, of course, there was not much motivation to work on the project if you work for $10 per hour.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was a way for me to get my very first experience. Now, I don't know if that's good. I think your opinion on this is that you should probably not do something like that, even if you're a complete beginner, or not a complete beginner in terms of programming knowledge, but with your first experience with freelancing. Does it make sense to ever start very low just to get a foot in the door, or should you always start at a reasonable rate, like $100 per hour, as you mentioned?
No, I've actually recommended that even people do something for free sometimes. Because if you don't have any clients, you don't have any experience, and you want to just see, you kind of maybe want to be able to build your portfolio even, and you know this is something you want to do, you might have to go build an app or a website for free. And that's actually how I started, is I knew some friends that needed a website for their company. I said, I'll do it. And I just did it just so I could get the experience. I just wanted the experience to say, I built that, and here's the public domain for it. And I could point people to it. So yeah, you can start low. However, I wouldn't be pricing yourself so low simply for the exact fact that what you just stated, your motivation will drop. It might be cool at first because you're excited about this new project. You can't wait to start it. You finally have your gig. But then after you're doing it for a few weeks, your motivation will just drop. Like, wow, this really stinks. Like, I do not want to work on this espresso bug that I've been fighting for 7 hours. And I'm getting paid $10 an hour. Like, I hate my life right now. So you want to make sure that you're working a wage in which you feel like, okay, good. I'm getting paid good for this work. And it may not be the best in the world, but it's got to be something that you're comfortable with and keeps you motivated too. But if you are starting out, yeah, you can start lower just to build your portfolio, but have that mindset of being like, hey, this is a short project. It's only a week long, 2 weeks long. This is only to build my portfolio. After this, I'm going to bump my rate up 10%, 50%, whatever it is, until I've built a little bit of a portfolio so my profile is a little bit stronger.
Okay, so people should be willing to start low. So they can't expect to get clients for $100 an hour right away.
No,
right?
No, I wouldn't expect right out of the gates. No, you have to provide experience. You have to show what you're capable of doing. I mean, it's social proof.
Yeah, and when I worked for $10 per hour, I also basically killed two birds with one stone then, because I created videos about this where I talked about my experience. So I turned this into some kind of content to use it beyond these $10 per hour that I get. Now, I didn't finish this vlog because it didn't really work. I didn't really like doing it, but this was my approach to this. And yeah, but as I said, it's hard to stay motivated if you work for this little money. Are there any general tips about negotiation that you have, or does it just come down to showing what you can do and that's basically it? Or are there any tricks when it comes to negotiation? Because there are whole books about this topic. And what I often say, for example, is that you should set a high price anchor and then negotiate towards a more reasonable price. But by setting a high anchor, you end up at a higher final price. But when I, for example, get emails about potential sponsorships in my videos, I know, for example, that if I set a high anchor, what often happens is that they just ghost me. There is no negotiation when I go too high. They just don't respond to it anymore. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, the price anchor thing does work. The problem that I've found with the price anchor is when you only provide the high anchor, and this is in my experience, is it just like you're experiencing, is people just disappear. They don't reply, they ghost, whatever. So what I have found in my experience is to always provide a range. And now what you can do is you can leave off a lot of the detail. And so let me give you an example. Let's say that you need to do, you're given a spec for a particular app you need to build. And you look at this and you're like, wow, okay. They don't give you all of the details. They don't give you, they never told you that when they mouse over, when they, someone, you know, presses a button, it needs to like animate really weird. Like they never told you that, but it might happen. So what you've encountered all these different things probably when you're developing, there's all different things that can happen and be very basic app. So what I'll do is I'll give a range, say, all right, well, this application could cost anywhere from, you know, it could be, let's just use a round number. It could be anywhere from $1,500 up to $2,600. And the client very often be like, wow, why is there such a wild variance range? Like, well, if you want the very basic bare minimum, well, then it's going to be this $1,500. If you want all the bells and whistles, it's going to be $2,600. Now, what's going to end up happening is the client's going to want the $1,500 one. But what that's done is also set the price anchor. Like, well, we're at $2,600. That's going to be the one with all the bells and whistles. If you want the one that has no analytics, it barely works, I give you the APK file and, you know, wash our hands, we're done with it, that's $1,500. So, and again, these are round numbers. I mean, I have given quotes to clients that have ranged from, hey, this application is going to cost you anywhere from $21,000 up to $54,000. And they're just like, whoa, why is that so wild? And I'm like, well, same thing. You want the very basic bare minimum, minimal feature set that does the bare minimum that your app needs? Or do you want all of those hundreds, you know, all those, you know, 50, 100 screens that you say you absolutely need? Well, if that's the case, that one's going to be 54,000. Which one do you want? And then what usually happens is that opens up the door for negotiation. And I've left off all the details, of course, because I've just said, hey, this app could cost this to this. Depends on what you need. Now communication starts. Like, all right, well, okay, why, what's for the cheap price? What's for the expensive price? Now you're actually going through a negotiation. You're going back and forth. And the same thing would happen, you know, for you, for the sponsorship. I did the same thing for Fragmented, is when we would have sponsors that would want to come on for Fragmented, which is my podcast with Kaushik. They would say, hey, what's, you know, how much is it for, you know, ads? And it depends on what it was. We'd say be X dollar amount to X dollar amount, depends on how long you want the ad read to be, depends on, you know, what you want us to say, depends on how much creative freedom we're given versus if you want us to read from a script. So there's a bunch of options that could be provided in there, but every time I gave them a range, it allowed me to continue driving that conversation forward, and it usually didn't end up dying. Or if it did, someone would come back saying, oh, wow, even your low number is too high for us. Like, okay, well, then like at that point, the conversation's still going. All right, what were you thinking? Oh, I was thinking this dollar amount. Okay, well, for that dollar amount, we'd have to shave off 80% of your feature set, but we could get you the bare minimum. Would that work for you? Like, I'll never give them more and kind of drive my price lower. I'll cut the feature set to match their budget.
Yeah, this is definitely a very interesting strategy by setting a range instead of just setting a high anchor. And I think this is also used in pricing psychology sometimes when you have different plans on a website, and then often these smaller plans only exist to bring people to the middle plan often, because the smaller plan is cheap, but the step and the additional features you get make people ignore this one basically. But it leads to a higher conversion overall because it's just a psychology trick. And maybe you have a similar effect when you set a range. Because you say, hey, if you really want to pay so little, you can work with me, but you will only get this and this. And then they might think, this is not really enough for me. But they are not scared off because there is a low price that they can look at. And I think I can really imagine overall that this just works better than just setting one high price.
Yeah. Yeah, it opens the door. It's a very psychological driven approach. You're 100% correct in that. Yes.
Yeah, it's definitely also a practice, because what I learned is you should definitely not set your price too low.
Yeah.
Again, I did the mistake when I worked for $10 per hour, but people are willing to pay more than you expect for a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I have some negotiations regarding sponsorships, and I got accepted for prices where I was first going to go lower than even half the price. But then I talked to some people and how much they charged, and then I went higher with my price, and it worked out. So it's a bit uncomfortable to set a high price, but it's important to not sell yourself too cheap. And sometimes you hear of these people that have ridiculously high freelance prices. For example, like $200-$300 per hour. I don't know if that's considered ridiculously high, but it sounds very high to me. Do you think that's something people can really reach when they work on themselves and on their brand and on their portfolio? Or is this completely unrealistic to charge something like $200-$300 per hour on a freelance project?
No, it's completely possible. You do have to be the top of your field. You do have to know what you're talking about. You have to have the, you know, the experience, the social proof that you can deliver on that rate. You know, the, it's a value proposition. Like, I'm going to pay you this much. What am I getting out of this? So there are many consulting firms, many that charge over $300 an hour in the United States. That, I mean, I could name a, I won't name the companies, but there's tons of them that charge that for, and freelancing and consulting, I'm using synonymous here because you're basically doing project-based work. So it is possible. You just have to be at the top of your field. And what I've found is that as soon as, at least in the United States, when you get above $150 an hour, you have to, it's the potential client base really starts thinning out. So it's really hard to find anyone above that area. Do they exist? Yeah, they do. It just becomes harder to find them. And that's where your network really becomes valuable. The people that you've become friends with, the, you know, the recruiters, the business associates you've made, those things end up paying off with more time and more experience. So you're not going to come out of the gate charging $200-$300 an hour, but it is definitely a possibility. If you keep at it long enough, eventually those opportunities will expose themselves.
Okay, so you have to work your way up. That's basically the gist. You should be willing to start maybe even for free if it's necessary, but it's possible to work your way up.
Yes, definitely. So you're going to be working your way up.
Okay, and in your book you also mentioned, and I heard a lot of other people say this too, that it's very important to not work without a contract.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that do this. They'll just... Working without a contract is a very good way to not get paid because there's no legally binding document that says you're owed this amount. If you're on Upwork, there's kind of contracts already built in for the client and employer service agreement, so that stuff's kind of handled for you. But if you're going direct to a client, you need to make sure that there is a contract in play that stipulates the, you know, where is the legalities of this located, where is, you know, what are the hourly rates? What's the stipulations of the payment terms and all those types of things? And then if for whatever reason you don't get paid, you can then involve a lawyer and say, hey, I didn't get paid for this. And then they can reach out and say, hey, based upon this contract, you're in breach of contract. You know, if you don't, you know, make payment within X amount of days, we'll then start a lawsuit. And just that in itself usually freaks companies out immediately to just pay you. And I've been down the road. I've had to get lawyers involved. So yeah, contract is a necessity.
What I found annoying when I started my first projects or my first freelance projects, and the reason why I actually did them without a contract, is that I didn't really know where to get one from. I had the idea to actually go to a lawyer, but then the problem is I had to make a big money investment just to get started, basically. Do you think that it's enough to get a template from the internet and use that one because they are free?
Yes, you can. A lot of the contracts you can find online are good. If it's including the, you know, the hourly rate, the payment terms, identification, you're going to see if it has a bunch of legalese in it and you can read it and understand it. That's going to be better than nothing. Like anything is better than nothing because then at least there's a signature and you want to make sure that both people have signed this before you start working. Now, there's a stipulation to that. Maybe you want to do a couple of hours of research work for them. That's fine. You can do that. You might want to do some discovery work. But if it's going to take you more than 8 hours, usually I recommend, you know, setting up a small discovery contract saying, hey, for us to really identify the scope of this project, it might take us 40 hours. So this would be a small 40-hour project where we figure out what's really entailed for this 6-month-plus project. That's something a lot of consulting firms do as well. So yeah, you want to make sure that it's you can get something from online from a template that'll work as well.
The idea that I always had was, why can't I just let the other side pay me every week and then I know don't need a contract, because even if they don't pay me, I just stop working for them. Is that not something that would work?
I mean, you could do that if, I mean, but then again, you're potentially leaving a week's worth of work on the table. I mean, if you're charging $100 an hour, I mean, it's a substantial amount of money. It's at that point, you know?
Yeah, that's true. But also the question is, inside the US, that's one thing. But do you think if you have a contract with someone from another country, maybe between US and India, for example, do you think it's realistic to even enforce this contract if something happens?
Yeah, that international law stuff is well beyond my pay grade at this point. That's difficult to really know what the legalities are across the legal boundaries and how and if they can be enforced. I'm not sure. And typically what I like to do anytime I'm working with a overseas contractor is I like to use something like Upwork, and I might even find them through another avenue and say, hey, can we just use Upwork and I'll pay a little bit extra so you don't get dinged on the fees, just so we can go through Upwork, because it's easier for me. They can just bill their hours. It just gets deducted from my account. I like to do that. I've recommended folks do that as well. However, I know that some people don't like to do that. It's kind of a comfort thing, is how much are you willing to, you know, it's a risk-based thing. How much are you willing to risk? If are you going to get paid or you're not going to get paid? You might want quicker payment terms, like you said, every week, or, you know, milestone-based payments. So there's just something you have to take into account.
Yeah, so no matter if you work across borders or not, it makes sense to have a contract, because you have something with signatures on it, and it always gives you a little bit more power when it comes to enforcing your side of the contract. Even if it would not really work, even if you wouldn't actually go to a court with it, just having it and just knowing that the other side knows that you have a contract with them probably already helps, no matter if it's within the same country or not. And yeah, then you can use something like milestones or getting paid weekly, or maybe on top of that, just to make sure that you have the second safety net, that you can still stop working if they end up not paying you. So maybe it makes sense to combine these different things.
Yeah, the only one that I'm worried about is the legal enforcement, because it's across country boundaries. That could just get really expensive and really difficult to do. But I agree with you that if you have a contract, and it's just going to keep people a little bit more honest at the end of the day.
Yes, and those are the main notes I made regarding freelancing. Are there any other common mistakes people do that come to mind when it comes to freelancing?
Just living beyond their means. In freelancing, yeah, you make a lot of money, and it's usually really good money. And if you all of a sudden make 75% more than you've ever made in your life, and then you start living at that level and spending all that money, that can be a very bad thing, just because you're just, you know, losing all of your income, and now you are basically known to be living with golden handcuffs, as they say. So you're having to make that same amount so you can live at that same level. So I recommend people just live under your means, save as much as you can, and you'll live a pretty good life, which is going to give you a lot of autonomy and freedom with freelancing.
Yeah, the same happens to people that have a normal job. They buy more stuff and increase their expenses of living, cost of living, because they want to flex, right? Yeah. They want to show off to others what they have. And it's really dangerous, in my opinion, because it can make people miserable.
Yes.
And I'm really a fan of living below your means. I mean, I don't make a lot of money anyway, but yeah, I don't have a car. I drive around with a bicycle, which also makes sense because it's healthier. But it also just, okay, if you need a car, then you need one. I don't need one right now. So I don't want to have one just to brag in front of other people if I don't actually need one. It's expensive, you have to repair it. Of course, some people have to drive somewhere regularly, then of course it makes sense. I just want to say that don't buy stuff that you don't actually need. Buy it when you really need it. And if you need it, maybe not buy the most shiny one, buy the one that makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And gives you the most bang for the buck.
Very, very wise advice.
Okay, so do you think overall freelancing is better than having a normal full-time job, or what are the pros and cons?
I think it depends on the person. I don't think freelancing is for everybody. Freelancing involves a level of stress and risk that a lot of people are not comfortable with. I don't know when I'm getting paid. I just don't know. I can't guarantee anything. I send my clients invoices on a regular basis, and I never get paid on time. Every single one of my checks is late. I've collected on every single one of my clients. No one has ever paid me, you know, early, except for maybe one or two people, and that was just by a fluke. A lot of people aren't comfortable with that. Like, it's not knowing when you're going to get paid next is kind of a stressful situation for a lot of people when you're used to working a full-time job. However, that comes with its benefits, is that I work for myself. If I don't want to work for a client anymore, I don't have to work for that client anymore. If the client wants me to do something and I don't agree with it, I can tell the client, I don't agree with that. And if we want to part ways, we can part ways. As long as I'm comfortable doing that and I have other clients lined up, that is a level of freedom that you just don't get with a full-time job. If your boss tells you, go make that button blue, or, you know, go do X, Y, and Z on a certain project, and you don't think that's the right thing to do, sure, you can argue your point, but at the end of the day, you have to do what your boss says. Now, of course, you have to do what your clients say, but it just offers you a lot more freedom. I work from my home. I work remotely. Sure, a lot of people work remotely with the current situation in the world right now, but I've been working this way for over 15 years now, and I couldn't trade it for the world. Just like you and many other people that you'll probably have on this podcast have been offered jobs at very good companies. But the level of freedom that I have right now, it almost can't be bought. It's something that I value very highly. Is it for everybody? No, it's not for everybody. Some people want to go work 8 hours a day. That's okay. That's fine. And they want to come home and they want to focus on fantasy football, and they want to focus on, you know, going to the park, or they have family duties or church duties or whatever. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You just have to kind of know what you want. And if you're not sure, give it a shot. Just try it out for on the side to see if you enjoy making the money. The worst case is, I always say this to myself, if I ever get tired of freelancing, I can just go get a job. So I have options. And for me, it works well.
Yeah, I'm also someone who values freedom more than comfort, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a personality thing, I think, because I had a lot of times and still have where there is no work-life balance at all.
Yep.
And I both make little money and have little free time, but I enjoy it, and I enjoy the freedom, and I enjoy waking up and being my own boss, and this is worth it for me. And I know that I need some patience and the money will follow anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's always a trade-off between freedom and comfort and constraints that can be helpful. Sometimes constraints can be helpful, because if you are your own boss and you work from home, then one thing that's really difficult, what some people that work in a job don't take into consideration, is how to stay productive when you are your own boss. That's not easy.
No.
If you don't have someone telling you when to work. And my mother is in the home office right now because of COVID, and she tells me that it's really difficult for her to even get out of bed and start working.
Mm-hmm.
Just because no one is telling her when to work. So this is a problem many people have. And of course, when you work at home, and especially when you don't have coworkers, then it can easily happen that you get very lonely.
Oh yeah.
This is also a point. And I'm personally someone I love being alone. I think I know no one else that is so comfortable with being alone as myself. So I don't have a problem with that, but I can really imagine that it can become really dark really quickly for some people.
Mm-hmm.
If they sit at home, maybe they have times where they don't get a job, and then can can lead you into really dark places, I imagine.
Yeah.
But this is something, as you said, you just have to try out, see what works for you, and you can still take a job later.
Yeah.
Just stay flexible. Okay. What did you want to add anything?
No, I was just going to say, I completely agree with you. It can get very lonely when you're working as a freelancer and you don't have coworkers. I don't see people at the office. I don't go to the office. So sometimes the only time I'll see somebody all day is on a Zoom call, or maybe I don't even have a Zoom call for a week. So there can be periods of time when I won't talk to anyone. And like you, I'm very comfortable being alone. I can go many, many days and just wake up and just execute and work on the things I want to work on. And so it works for me, but it's not for everybody. And this is one reason why I recommend anyone who is doing remote-based work as well as freelancing to go do something outside of the house once
sports.
A day. Yeah, sports. And so as I recommended to you, like, hey, try jiu-jitsu. And I do, I do like group fitness classes. I used to do jiu-jitsu. And so every day I'll go do like a group fitness class. And that's my social hour. That's when I get to go see people, interact. I don't do something that's coding. And it helps me socially and mentally in enormous ways. Has it helped you?
Yes, but even before jiu-jitsu, which I love, by the way, I'm really happy that you introduced me to it. It's amazing. It's an amazing sport, an amazing way to stay fit. But even before then, I was going to the gym multiple times a week, and I would recommend anyone who works at home to do some kind of sports just to get out of the house sometimes. It's really important, and it keeps your mind healthy. And if you are, there are some people I know that work from home that don't do sports at all, and then you're just asking to get into bad states. Just asking for it.
Yeah, cabin fever is a real thing. I mean, have you heard that term, cabin fever?
I know the term, but I don't really know what it means.
It just kind of, you just go crazy. You're going crazy at home. Like you're in the same environment for so long. It's just like, you just start going crazy. Like you need to get out. So cabin fever will happen with, remote. I think even in the remote book, which was by David Hanemeyer Hansen and Jason Fried from Basecamp, they even talked, they had a section on cabin fever as well. So yeah, you got to get out of the house.
Yeah. So people who will listen to this, don't ignore this. I know that some people already, they're not listening anymore because they already made up their mind about sports. I don't want to do this, but don't ignore this. It's really important.
It is.
Otherwise you will regret it later. Mm-hmm. There was also a term that I noted down that you mentioned in your book that was Hell Week. Do we want to say a few words about this, what Hell Week is? In terms of freelancing?
Yeah, I was just talking to a friend. It's interesting you bring that up because someone here locally had bought my book and I'm friends with them on Instagram and they are going through what's known as a Hell Week. So what is Hell Week? Hell Week, the term is coined from the U.S. Navy SEALs. And in the U.S. Navy SEALs, there's a training program that they go through. And part of that training program is called Hell Week. And it's basically 1 week of absolute hell. And they're getting a couple hours of sleep a night and they're just doing the most rigorous exercise. It's hell on earth. And I stole that term and I basically say you're going to encounter, a few hell weeks a year usually. I usually say about once a quarter. So about four a year, you'll have four hell weeks a year. And what does that mean in regards to consulting? This also applies to full-time jobs as developers, software developers in general. A hell week is going to be when you have a product launch or when maybe a system goes down or something like that. There's just something crazy happening. Usually it's around product launches though. And you are working 60 to 80 hours a week. This, is going to last for about a week and then it'll die down. And what I recommend folks do is just know that you're probably going to have four of these a year. Does that mean it's going to happen every 3 months? No, absolutely not. You might have two hell weeks consecutively. So you might have 2 weeks straight of hell, but you may not have another one for 6 to 8 months. That's fine. But on average, over my career, I've noticed it happens about four times a year, just simply around product releases, system crashes, stuff like that. And when you see these coming, you'll know they're coming just because, if it's a system crash, you know it immediately. But if it's a product launch, let your family and your friends know or anyone that's close to you and say, hey, look, I'm going to be busy, like enormously busy. I'm not going to be able to take the kids to, baseball practice, or I'm not going to be around to go to this event. because I've got this thing going on at work. It should only last about a week. After that, everything will go back to normal. Just let everyone aware and know. And then also tell yourself, like, look, this is going to be a really long week. I gotta push through it. And it just kind of comes with the territory. Now, in a perfect world, should those hell weeks happen? No. Teams and companies should actually be able to say, hey, we're going to plan accordingly so nobody has to go through a hell week. But that's just not the reality of the industry. You know, things happen and we encounter these situations. So if you plan for them and you have the right mental mindset around them, they won't affect you as badly.
Okay, but if I understood this correctly, the same happens in normal jobs. It's not just a freelancing thing.
Yes, it happens in normal jobs too, yep.
I just don't want people to think that we are promoting what some people call toxic productivity. We are not saying that you should work 80 hours per week every week. It's just that sometimes it's necessary for a short period of time. And it probably won't kill you to have these short sprints where it becomes really tough. It's just a necessity.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not something I'm promoting. It shouldn't be that way. If companies worked correctly, they would plan accordingly and they would have, you know, remediation built in to make sure these things don't happen. But, you know, things like this do happen and it's just kind of par for course. And just, in my opinion, it's a mindset thing. You have to understand it's going to happen and just kind of roll with it. Now, if it happens every other week, well, that's kind of, yeah, that's a culture that you probably don't want to be involved with too much.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I think we covered most of the interesting stuff when it comes to freelancing, unless there's anything else you want to add.
No, I think we got a lot covered there. I mean, there's tons of topics we can talk about, but I think that's covers a good section.
Yeah, people should definitely check out the book. And I will also put your freelancing playlist into the show notes, which is a YouTube playlist where you also share a lot of interesting information. You also created a project called AndroidJobs.io. Is that someone people can look for? Is that something people should check out? But those are not for freelance projects, right? Those are normal jobs.
Yeah. So at the time of this recording, Android Jobs, you can go and post jobs there for free. So if your company is hiring, doesn't matter if it's contract, remote, on-prem, whatever, you can go post a job there for free. We have all different types of companies that have posted there, from, you know, places like Instagram and Pandora, and, you know, all the way to just regular startups and local companies have posted there. Job postings are free now. If you are a developer who's interested in finding a job, contract, remote, whatever, you can go there and sign up to the email list every week. I believe it's on Friday. We email, an automated email goes out of the new job postings that week, and they'll just end up in your inbox. So it's a free site for you to use. And it's tailored just for Android-specific jobs.
Really nice. So again, I will put all of this into the show notes. Yeah, one question that's not related to freelancing, but we don't have to talk about this very long. Of course, most of my followers are Android developers. And since I had this topic recently, do you think Flutter or any other cross-platform framework is the future of Android in comparison to, or is it better than native? And you also told me once in the Instagram DMs that you think that web is the future, that web will actually replace native apps. Is that something you still think of?
I don't think web will, let me rephrase that then. If it's, I don't want to confuse anyone. I don't think web's going to replace all native apps. There's still going to be the need for native apps, you know, things like maps. I don't know if maybe one day that'll be web. I don't know. But right now, and the way it is I don't see that moving off of a native app for a long time. There's a lot of integration points into the native ecosystem that are very useful. Notifications, things like that. There's media players, video, YouTube, stuff like that. Those are going to remain. Video games. Those are all going to remain native. Now, do I think that, and I'll come back to the web thing in a second, do I think that Flutter or some other framework is going to replace native? I don't think it's going to replace. I think it's an alternative. And there are certain times to use it, and there are certain times that you shouldn't use it. And it really depends upon the use case. I don't think you can say, hey, I'm going to write every single thing in Flutter. However, for me, if I'm going to be building a forms over data application and I need a Android and an iOS client, and this is the big caveat, it's an and. If I need both clients and I have not written a line of code for either yet, immediately, if I don't need media playback, if I don't need deep system integration, for me, I'm going to lean on Flutter. Now, a lot of people are like, well, that's, you know, you can use Kotlin multi-platform. Yeah, you can do that too. If that's what you want to use, use that. For me, I'll use Flutter simply because I just have to write it once. I don't have to hop into Xcode. I mean, except for one tiny thing. I don't have to hop into Android Studio except for one thing. I mean, I can write it in Android Studio or VS Code or whatever. But for me, I'll use Flutter for a lot of stuff. That doesn't mean it's going to replace native at all. I think that native is going to be around for a very long time. It's going to be very viable, especially with things like Jetpack Compose and so forth. It's just, I think we're going to see many more decisions being made, especially by companies, because companies are tired of spending the costs for two different teams. Almost all of the larger clients I've been to, I mean, they have an iOS team and an Android team, and we write the same exact thing in two different languages. And I'm not the only one who sees this. It's the managers see this. The VPs see this. They see this at the bottom line. Like, we are writing the same app twice. They're building design systems, you know, so all right, all the buttons should be blue with a, you know, three pixel border radius on iOS and Android. So when you look at each app on both platforms, it looks exactly the same. So we're writing the same app twice in two different languages. And so for me, Flutter allows me to just kind of do that once. And so I'll use that a lot of the time. Now, again, you have to understand the people's ego investments into why they're recommending that. Again, I am a freelancer, I'm a consultant. So for me, it's providing a product to the client to solve their needs at that given time. That might be getting a product out to test the market. And a lot of the times that's what I do. I build something to test the market. If the market responds to it and the market sees value into it and it starts making money, at that point in time, they may decide, hey, we need to add all these features that require us to be native, and we might need to rewrite it in iOS or Android native or whatever. That might be what they have to do. And that's a situation they'll handle in the future. And I let them know of that in advance. Now, someone else who is just a native developer, who's only worked in Android, and that's their, you know, that's where they spend all of their time, they may be completely vehemently against Flutter because they do not see the reason for it whatsoever, because they just do everything native. Okay, that's fine for them. That's their ego investment that they have into the platform. So no, it's not going to replace it. It'll augment it. Just depends on the situation. Now, will web win? I still feel that the web is going to win eventually. The web is just a beast of interconnectivity. And I just think what we're going to see, and we're continually going to see this, is the networks are going to get faster. These devices in our hands are going to get faster. They always do. They're going to get more and more powerful. And what happens when things get more and more powerful? We can do crazy things in the web. 10, 15 years ago, if you told me that you would have a Photoshop-like or Adobe Illustrator-like experience in the browser, like Figma or any of these other ones, like, I would have told you you're crazy. But no, now we're doing it. Like, I don't even need to have a lot of these vector tools installed. I just go to a website. So basically what I'm saying is the web is getting more and more powerful. The technology is advancing. And what we're going to eventually see, in my opinion, this is my prediction, is we're going to see more native hooks into the system. Eventually, we're going to be able to publish notifications from a website. I mean, we could kind of already do it on the browser, but we're going to have deep system level native integration from a website. We're going to have more sensor integration where we can just talk to the sensors. There's going to be more standards that are created. And eventually, we'll be able to write as much of the stuff in the web as we want. But there'll still be a case for native because there is a lot of stuff that just needs to be written that's very close to the metal. And native's not going to go anywhere, just like C isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, I also use a tool since a few days called Veed.io, Veed.io. Which is also basically a video editor that works completely in the browser. It's pretty impressive. But of course, there's always still some level of clunkiness to it as compared to a real native app. And the question maybe is if this will ever be able to really be overcome, this clunkiness compared to a real platform app.
hard to say if it's going to be, you know.
Time will tell.
Yeah, it's really hard time to tell. If you go back to, I mean, when I started in the web, the first web, first time I hopped on the web was 1997. And that was, I could never imagine the stuff that we're doing in the web now. We are in the browser here in Chrome recording this podcast in a video format, high fidelity audio streaming over the web, talking to each other. You're in Germany, I'm in New Jersey. Like 97, I would have like, that didn't even cross anyone's mind. Like that was impossible. Back then, paying for something online was impossible. So is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. When? Who knows? I just feel eventually we're going to get there.
Yeah. Okay. But it's no reason for people to stop learning native right now.
Absolutely not. No, keep learning. Like, if you're doing native, you like Android, keep doing Android. If you like iOS, keep doing iOS. I always tell people this all the time. They say, Don, what should I learn right now? What's the new hot thing? And I'm like, you know what? Just do what interests you. Like, if you're really interested in Android, then go learn Android. If you're really interested in Kubernetes and like you love that networking stuff, then go learn Kubernetes. Like, if you're interested in programming car stereos at Tesla at the C-level language, then go do that. Like, there is so much opportunity in tech. We can't find enough people to fill the jobs. So just go learn and do what you want to do and have fun with it.
Yeah, and if you build programming skills, then you can usually take them over to a different product or different framework without starting from scratch again. So people should not be so afraid of wasting time, because they are not wasting time as long as they are learning. And I also want people to know that I'm not hostile against Flutter. It's just that I have ignored it completely so far. Because on my YouTube channel, I focused on native Android and I wanted to put all my time into this. And I don't have an opinion about Flutter at all personally, because I have never tried it out. Maybe I would like it. Yeah, that's basically it for my questions. I think it's also a really nice length for the podcast. And all the links we already mentioned, I will put into the show notes. I will also put a link to the book there, of course, so people can buy it. And are there any other places where you want people to reach out to you? You're really active on Twitter, right?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram and on my website and YouTube. So I'll make sure you get those links, and those will be the best places. It depends on what platform you like to frequent. You can send me a DM on any of those, or send me an email through my website, and I'll reply when I have time.
Okay, really nice. Then, Don, I thank you for coming up on the show.
Thanks for having me, Florian.
And wish you a nice rest of the day.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Coding in Flow podcast. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe either on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast from. If you're watching this on YouTube, please also leave a like on this video and write a comment below with any suggestions, any opinions about the topics we talked about in this episode. I actually read all of these comments. If you're listening to this on Apple Podcast, please leave a 5-star rating if you think this show deserves it. And also check out our sponsor. This is a great way to support the show. You can find the link in the show notes. My name is Florian Walter, and you can find me on most social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever, under the handle @codinginflow. That's just one word, codinginflow. You're also welcome to join our Discord community, which of course is free. It's a nice place where you can talk with other programmers about programming and non-programming related topics, where you can get help from, discuss code and stuff like that. And you can find this community under codinginflow.com/discord. Then again, I thank you for listening to this episode. I hope I see you in the next one. Take care.